think we're close to starting time. This is the second of a series of five sessions, seminars, talks, lectures, conversations, whatever you want to call them, plus one more that's going to be this evening at 8:15 after Vespers, which is a DVD made by a very close friend of mine. I'm actually in this DVD, so anybody doesn't show up, he's no friend of mine. I have a very small kind of a cameo role, but it's called Health, Money, and Fear, and it really gives a pretty good background about what's going on in the healthcare world, why we're having so many problems now, and how we might go about fixing it. It talks a lot about the profit that's in the system, the abuse that's in the system, and the lack of primary care relative to the specialists, and some of the things that we talked about in the first session. So the first session was about healthcare, health and healthcare, kind of a background of what is health, how do we define health, how do we look at it from a personal perspective, from a national and an international perspective, and what about the healthcare crisis and how can we address that? We left a lot of loose ends. The second session was designed to talk about aging and health, or successful aging. And we're going to spend some time talking about that, but I got thinking about two things about aging. Number one is, this is bringing coal to Newcastle. I think there is no better group of people that represent successful aging than this group right here. Not that we're aged a whole lot, but we are in this process of getting older. And it's from everybody I've talked to and seen, you're doing just the kinds of things that really do lead to successful aging. So you don't need to spend we don't need to spend a whole lot of time on that. The other thing is, if we do affect meaningful healthcare reform in this country in this next year, then that will have a much bigger impact on your aging, your successful aging, and your successful health than anything that we can otherwise talk about today. So I want to go back a little bit, review a few of the things that we talked about on the first session yesterday, and then expand and get in some further discussion about some of the healthcare issues, and then we'll get into some issues about aging. Just a couple comments about references. I again want to emphasize this book by T.R. Reid, R-E-I-D, called The Healing of America. It's a new book just out. I think Mr. Reid has crystallized what some of the main issues are in the healthcare debate and discussions that are going on, and really explains how other countries have addressed the same problems and have solved many of those problems. Every country still has problems, but only the United States has the problems to the extent that we have of all the industrialized countries. A couple of the books relating to aging. One is a book by Sherwin Newland, How We Die. It's been around for a long time. It's an excellent summary of, if you just want to learn more about diseases and diseases at the end of life, and what one might expect with a number of things. He is a very compassionate physician, a surgeon at Yale. Jimmy Carter wrote a great little book called The Virtues of Aging. The Nun Study, anybody familiar with The Nun Study by David Snowden? He studied a group of nuns at that age and came up with some remarkable conclusions in how one can prevent Alzheimer's disease, or at least maybe delay its onset. So those are books I would certainly highly recommend. But if you're only going to get one book that has a medical flavor to it, you just want to learn more about disease and health and what haven't done, I would strongly recommend this book by Sherwin Newland. And if you really want to know about what we might be able to learn from other countries in the healthcare crisis, and we really have to do that, the book by Reid is excellent. On Monday, we talked about health and wellness and healthcare, and made the distinction between what's health and what's healthcare. I think we pretty much agree as a group that health is really more than the absence of disease. It's really a sense of physical, mental, and spiritual well-being. health in itself, certainly health care is not a goal. So when you hear somebody in Washington, D.C. say, oh, we've got to provide more health care, or that's not a goal into itself. Even health itself is not a goal. Health is a means that enables each of us to fulfill our own lives and our own activities. And if we have a healthy nation, we can obviously do a lot more than if we don't have a healthy nation. And we talked about a lot of things that might affect good health. Genetics certainly plays a role. Personal habits and activities, exercise, the environment plays a role. Interestingly, the access to health care plays a relatively minor role when it actually comes to the health of a population. Can do great things for individuals. And we'll look a little bit later at how longevity has changed, and when the greatest improvements in longevity and health occurred, it had very, very little to do with health care. We're just sort of beating around the edges in terms of health. So if we really want a healthy population and a healthy society, putting more money or more into health care may not be the way to go. And so that's kind of I guess Jim would call that, is that a paradox, Jim, or is that just a contradiction or whatever it is that a healthcare person who's earned all his living, in the healthcare is standing up here and saying, or sitting here and saying, don't throw more money at us because maybe that's not really what we need. So health is not necessarily the goal in itself. The other thing we did, and I'm going to pass these around, I don't think I have enough for everybody, but if you would share them, is the tabular form of health statistics from around the world. I picked six or seven countries, and we looked at the United States, and we looked at Canada, Great Britain, France, and Germany, and China, and even Liberia, to look at what their various statistics, what the World Health Organization shows for statistics, and compare that to the amount of money that is spent both as a percentage of gross domestic product and as an absolute dollar amount. And if Consumer Reports were doing this, you would have a few of these countries would be recommended. They would get a check mark up at the top. Maybe nobody gets a Best Buy, but they would certainly be recommended. And the recommended countries would be Canada, Great Britain, Germany, France, and Japan, that those countries provide pretty good outcome data, pretty good statistics, for a relatively reasonable price. Countries like China and Liberia would probably get not acceptable because they are too poor to provide the kind of healthcare that most of us would like. And the United States would clearly get a not acceptable because it costs way, way too much. The outcomes aren't very good. And we have an unjust and unethical system in which we exclude large numbers of our population. So I think if a Consumer Report were doing this, we would have an unacceptable healthcare system. There would be a group of countries, the developed countries, that would be acceptable and even recommended, but not necessarily Best Buy. And every country and every healthcare system is really facing the problems, the combined problems of demographics, older populations, and increasing technology and demands for health for healthcare, especially as we get older. One point we made on Monday, and I really want to emphasize this, probably more than anything. The most important, and there's lots of data. I'm just not making this up. I'm not like Don there, who just makes up facts. this is the truth. So I make up a lot of things, but this one is the truth. There's increasing amount of data for this, to support this. And that is the primary determinant of health and wellness has only moderate impact by genetics, by habits, by environment, and by the healthcare system. But what it does, what really impacts it, is the socioeconomic status of the individual and the relative status. This is even more important, the relative status to other people in the society. So if you have a society which has relatively homogeneous wealth distribution. And most of the European countries are that way, especially the Scandinavian countries. They do not have the extremes of wealth that we have, or that Liberia has, or even that China or Russia has, or many South American countries, which have great, great extremes of wealth. If you have a society that is closer in terms of wealth distribution, the health of those societies tends to be better. The outcomes tend to be better. Even the richer people in those societies tend to do better than the very, very, very extremely rich people in those societies that have this wide distribution of wealth. And it's almost counterintuitive, maybe another paradox, as to why the people on Wall Street and the CEOs of companies that are making huge amounts of money, it's obscenely high, can make that kind of money. They are actually sacrificing years off their life by doing that. Not because they're working too hard or other things, but because the society that they live in has a lower life expectancy, and that includes them. So it's almost like a just punishment. But unfortunately, we all suffer because of that. And then you can say, well, why? There's a lot of theories to it. The theory that seems to be most commonly accepted is that societies like that have a lot more stress in them. That those at the top are constantly in a struggle to stay at the top, and they feel that pressure. And certainly those individuals that are poor or feel they're poor and kind of have their face rubbed in the fact that they're poor is extremely stressful for individuals. There's a lot of shame in being poor in this country, a lot of shame. And shame correlates with bad health. And all you have to do is go to any emergency room. All you have to do is go to almost any doctor's office or find any list of people with diabetes or heart disease or anything else, and you're going to find disproportionate number of people that are poor. Not that rich people live well and never get sick, but it's disproportionate. Illness does not distribute itself equally throughout the population. The poor get more diseases than do the rich. So the past 20 years has been a trend in this society to see greater extremes of wealth and poverty. And we have, and our, aggressively during that period of time, our ranking in terms of health has fallen compared to other industrial countries. And not only industrial countries, some of our statistics are even worse than some of the developing countries. Any questions about that? Does anybody disagree with that they just can't see that relationship exists? So to the extent that we can bring society into a more homogeneous, that's not to take away incentives to work hard and to be productive and to be innovative, but to avoid the kind of extremes of wealth and poverty might be one of the most important things we could do to improve the health of the nation, perhaps even more important than I think definitely more important than pouring more money into the healthcare system.
So, Cliff, is that discussion covered in that Reed book? Kevin, if you wanted to read more,
there is a. I can get you the reference. There's an emergency room physician in Seattle who has written about that, and there have been several articles in the past couple of years in the New England Journal of Medicine, and I can get you some references on the socioeconomic status and relating that to health.
Okay. I just stepped into the discussion a moment ago, but I understand that there's a strong correlation between social connections and good health and longevity.
There absolutely is, and we will discuss that in considerably more detail when we talk about religion, religiosity, spirituality, and health, because interconnectedness is very, very important. There are lots and lots of factors that influence health. You know, we could come up with a list of 30, 40 different things. You know, drinking wine. I mean, being a geologist is good for your health. We heard that this afternoon for a number of reasons. So, and not the least of which is drinking a little bit of beer. So,
hey, Cliff.
Yes.
When is that talk, the one about spirituality and...
The spirituality is tomorrow at 4 o'clock here, and it's kind of a PowerPoint presentation. I'm going to be giving it, and so it's a little different format, but we're going to really look at evidence in which spirituality or religiosity and religious type behaviors impact health. We're also going to look at the role of intercessory prayer and what we have learned. From a secular, I just want to preface everything. From a secular point of view, I'm not coming at this from a from the point of view of any organized religion or any spiritual basis, but rather as a medical professional looking at what kind of evidence there is out there, because there have been a number of studies and some attempted good studies, including some very well funded studies looking at, for instance, the intercessory prayer and its impact on the recovery from heart disease or coronary procedures and things of that sort. But your point is a good one about interconnectedness, social structure, involvement as we get older. That's why the very, very first comment I made here about aging and this group, this is an example of people interacting, having those kind of interrelationships that are so important for oneself.
You know, there's a saying in that. Islamic world that a day spent fishing is a day, not that all it doesn't take away from your lifespan. And it may be that a week spent at Holden is a week.
Good point.
Try hanging around with Cliff for a week.
It might drive you to doing something that wouldn't be so good. All right. We started a little bit of discussion about the U.S. healthcare system. We said, you know, if you're a congressman or if you're a criminal, those two might be the same. You get health care, if you're very, very poor, you get it, and if you're not so poor, you don't get it. And I also mentioned that there were two governors that really kind of understand it. One was Governor Lamb of Colorado, and we passed out a couple articles about that he wrote. I hope you had a chance to read those, because I think he's very perceptive. And the other governor is the governor from my state, and from some of us from Oregon, John Kitzhaber, who was the author of the Oregon Health Plan, which really started to look at things instead of rationing people on and off of Medicaid. He said, let's ration the services so that everybody gets their basics coverage, and then we could have a list, and he had the public go out and actually have input in development, and they could develop a list of like 650 types of services that you could get from in the medical world. Everything from an immunization of a child, and removal of appendix, to plastic surgery for breast reduction or breast enhancement, or some liposuction or something of that down at the other end, of greatest value for health, least value for health. And then you would draw a line, depending on how much money you had, as to what you would cover. So you're not going to cover some of these things of relatively marginal benefit, but you would cover for everybody the basic services. Brilliant, simple way of looking at how we can deliver healthcare. It has not panned out well in Oregon. There's not been a lot of support for that. There's been constant battles with the federal government getting waivers to do these kinds of things, and the plan ultimately was to cover all everybody in Oregon under that plan. But what we have instead is a hodgepodge of things. And if, just imagine now, a new country has just formed somewhere, and they want to make a healthcare system, they want to come out with a law, they have a legislature, let's just call that country Utopia. And it exists somewhere. One of those new islands that have formed out there that Don was telling us about. It has a population of, let's say, 3 or 4 million people there. They want to have a healthcare system, and they come to the United States and they say, give us a bill that represents the healthcare system of the United States. You know, tell us what it would be. And John Kitzhaber has actually written this, a little tongue-in-cheek, but it's absolutely quite revealing, I think, as to what the U.S. healthcare system is, because what this is the U.S. healthcare system right here in a form that might appear before Congress.
Do I remember that Kitzhaber is an M.D.?
Kitzhaber is an M.D. Governor Lamb is not an M.D. John Kitzhaber was an emergency room physician in Roseburg, graduate of Oregon Health Sciences University and a and the governor of Oregon for 8 years. So John Kitzhaber says, here's what he's proposing is the Health Care Equity and Empowerment Act. That's a great, you know, I mean, it's just what Congress does. They come up with some kind of name, and how could you vote against the Health Care Equity and Empowerment Act? But here's what it says, because this represents the U.S. healthcare system. Number one, and it's 5 points. Number one, there shall be no overall healthcare policy in this country. That's what we have. We have no overall healthcare policy. Number two, we shall distinguish between two groups, the deserving poor and the undeserving poor. Now, the deserving poor are women on welfare and certain people with end-stage renal disease, just kidney disease and kidney failure who need dialysis, the disabled, and some impoverished elderly. They will get health care. But the undeserving poor will not get health care. The undeserving poor consists of all the other poor people, all men who are poor, all women who don't have children. That's the way our system works. Now, point three, everyone over the age of 65 shall have a fairly comprehensive health care policy, whether they're poor or not. So you can be 65 and barely making it and you get Medicare, or you could be Warren Buffett with a net worth of something like $40 billion, B with a B, billion dollars, and you get Medicare. And Warren doesn't have to pay any more than anybody else does. And who pays for that policy? That is going to be paid for by current workers. There is no trust fund. There is not. Everybody on Medicare is retired. Well, those of you in the room here are on Medicare and retired. Medicare is being paid for by the workers. Now, point four, all workers shall pay 2.9% of their salaries to pay the health insurance for those over 65. Whether or not those workers who are paying the 2.9% have any health insurance themselves. Well, that's really fair, isn't it? And then the majority of workers who pay for those that are over 65 will be in some type of managed care or PPO plans, restricted plans, because that's what most commercial plans have, some restrictions. They have tiers. You know, you can go to these network providers or not those network providers. Whereas anyone over 65 can have unmanaged fee-for-service care. Now, I'm not saying Medicare is perfect, but so this is our U.S. healthcare system, and who would vote for that? Who would adopt a system like that? Nobody. Nobody should. Anybody here really think the healthcare system is working great in this country? Well, you know, for some people, it's working pretty well. Actually, for lots of people, it's working fairly well. It's too expensive. But it's working fairly well, and that is part of the problem. If one looks at it purely from an individual point of view, most of us, I suspect, in this room can get pretty good health care, get it within a reasonable amount of time, and it's not putting us in a poor farm. Most of us in this room, and most of us in this room vote, and there's lots and lots of people who obviously get put in the poor farm, so to speak, metaphorically. And then many, many become bankrupt. In this country, the statistic is 700,000 individuals go bankrupt every year because of medical expenses.
It's the leading cause of personal bankruptcy.
I'm sorry? It's the leading cause, yes. All right. What I would like to do, I would like all of you, when you leave here, to feel really comfortable about the healthcare debate so that you can enter in a conversation with almost anybody from any political persuasion and be able to talk with some confidence about what's going on. It is horribly complex and it is horribly hard. And so there are a few little things that I hope that we can convey and share. One of them is this chart, so that if somebody says we got the best healthcare system in the world, why would we want to change it? You can show them a number and say, you know, okay, how, in what way do we have the best healthcare system? We have the most expensive healthcare system, but we don't have the best outcomes. And you can actually show them data. And I put the website on the bottom, so if somebody says, well, where do those numbers come from? It's the WHO website. Yes.
There's just a couple things. Could you clarify what they are, the life expectancy ones and down below the focus?
Okay, I'm going to need your thing back,
okay.
So. POP is population, and that's in millions up there. GDP per capita is in thousands, and you can see that little Liberia over there, they don't even make a thousand, it's not 260,000, it's $260 a year. Life expectancy, male over female, and healthy life expectancy. This is if you can expect to reach that age without major disability. Then there's the probability of dying at less than 5 years. That's per 1,000 individuals. And then the probability of dying between 15 and 60 per 1,000 individuals. And then there's the expenditure per capita in dollars. That's the 206 figures. And there's the expenditure as a percent of the gross domestic product overall for the country as a whole. So just looking at that bottom number, you can see that China spends 4.5% of its gross domestic product on healthcare. We spend 15.3%. The United Kingdom spends half of that, 8.4%. Canada, Germany spends 10%. Japan spends about 8%. So this you have some ammunition right there to talk about and some actual data. I want to quote something to you, and because this is really important, it says, if they can get you asking the wrong questions, the answers don't matter. Think about that for a minute. If they can get you asking the wrong questions, the answers don't matter. So if we're talking about healthcare, and somebody starts asking you questions about, are there going to be death panels? That's the wrong question. That's not what we're talking about. So you can spend all afternoon discussing whether there's death panels or whether there's going to be any form of rationing, any form of limitation of services, but which could be interpreted as, well, that's somebody might die because of that, therefore it's a death. You don't go there. So don't let the people who have really vested interest, one way or the other, to ask those wrong questions. Make sure we ask the right question. Ask the moral question. Is it moral? Is it just? Does anybody here feel good at the fact that 15 or 16 or 18% of the population has no health coverage whatsoever? Do you feel good about it? If you feel good about that, then you might as well get up and say, well, there's got to be a good reason for that. And I don't know what that reason would be, except to punish people that have lost their job or that changed their job or that retired at 62 and can't get health insurance or have a pre-existing condition. Okay, 3 points about the healthcare debate. Number one, the current system is broken. It is a non-system. It is inefficient. It is unethical, and it's unsustainable. Those are good reasons why we probably ought to work toward changing it. It had all these things. All these adjectives could be applied to it 25 years ago. Certainly, at the beginning of the Clinton administration in 1993, they were applied to it, and it's only gotten worse, and it's only going to get worse. And the longer we wait, the more difficult it's going to be to change it. The other thing, fixing it involves two things, and they're different. They're related, but they're different. Universal coverage. That's a moral issue. And if we at Holden don't agree with that, then there's some real problems here. It's a moral issue that we need to cover everybody. Number two, but when universal coverage means cover everybody, not cover everything. Okay? Anybody disagree with that? And the second part of that is that we have to set limits. We have to recognize that there's limits. And more of something means less of something else. It's not the American tradition. I mean, we have this image that we can do anything and everything and that we have unlimited resources, and obviously we don't. So we have to recognize that we have trade-offs, that we do have to set limits. Okay. Do I sound like I'm preaching up here?
Yeah. No.
Okay, I'll.
Oh, no.
I have to listen to her. Remember that people like me, physicians, there's a couple of physicians here in the room, people that have earned their living from the off this broken, unethical, unsustainable healthcare system. It's a $2 trillion business. Trillion with a T per year. That's a huge amount of money. Really huge. And don't think for a minute that lots of people, lots of companies are not benefiting significantly from that. A lot of people are dependent on their livelihood on that $2 trillion. And although most people recognize that the system is not perfect and not ideal and not really sustainable, they still have entrenched interests that interfere with how much change. So there's a lot of individuals that would like a little bit of change, a little tweak here, a little tweak there, but basically it's serving them very well and they don't want to do it. And so the code words that when you're out there talking to people that you're going to run into are socialized medicine, rationing, used to be Hillary Care, now it's Obamacare. And don't think for a minute there isn't some racial overtones to Obamacare. I think there really are. And pulling the plug on grandma, death panels, all these things. Jim Bodine would really like all these terms. I mean, they're all kinds of metaphorical terms that get us off track.
Now, the poets only record the metaphors that are used by others. You know, we don't. These are not our metaphors. You know, we are witness. The poets are witnesses to the metaphor, not the creators of them. That's a distinction in role. That's why we're not at the table.
That's why you said you got here.
No.
Just a couple brief things about rationing. Rationing has horrible connotations and bad feelings in the United States. Yes?
What's the difference between rationing and setting limits?
No, none. Uh-huh. However, rationing has a sense. Limits. I mean, setting limits, I guess you got to set limits. You say rationing, it just has a very negative connotation, partly because of the experience of World War II. So there's a generation, there's still some from that generation that remember the rationing that went on there. Partly because it's inconsistent with the American dream that there's always going to be more, there's sort of unlimited resources. We moved, there was a whole continent to be exploited. And it was no reason that we couldn't essentially do anything and everything that we wanted to do. Very simple discussion about rationing. It went up because people are going to say they're against. You know, it was so, how many people here? I already asked this question last time. I won't ask it again because nobody raised their hand that they were against. What did I ask the question? Whatever it was, everybody here was sort of against. For rationing or recognized that they had not for rationing. It's sort of like recognize that rationing had to occur, that we have to set limits. But when you ask the American people, when the Gallup organization goes out and asks American people about rationing, they get 80-90% of people oppose it. When they say, do you think there should be limits set on what medical care should be provided on the basis of cost and money and expenditures? The majority of American people say, no, I don't think there should be limits. I think we ought to be able to get whatever we need, whatever is going to benefit us, that's what we should have. It may be the way the question's phrased, but rationing carries a big negative connotation.
But people are so uninformed.
Right, so that's going to be your job to go out there and help inform them. Mm-hmm. And one way to do it is to say, let's just take a 65-year-old woman with breast cancer, and we have a treatment. That treatment might be a chemotherapy, or it might be a radiation, or it might be a drug, or it might be some genetic thing. and we can prolong her life by 6 months. This is somebody with metastatic cancer, but we can prolong her life for 6 months. It's going to cost $100. Should we do it?
$100.
$100. And almost everybody says, well, of course. $100 and 6 months of life. I mean, 6 months of good quality life and meaningful life, a chance to see your grandkids grow up a little, or a child get a degree from college, whatever. Well worth it. So this person that's opposed to rationing, you say, well, would you pay $1,000 for that? And they would probably say yes. And you just keep raising that price in your discussion. $10,000 for 6 months for one person? $100,000? $1 million? At one point, they're finally going to say, no, we can't pay $10 million for one person to get 6 months of life. That just, we can't afford it. Somebody can't. Now, Bill Gates wants to pay for his mother to have whatever that treatment is, and it's going to cost $1 million, and that's fine, but society can't do it. So I think that kind of addresses that. The other issue relates to socialized medicine. And how many people think that Great Britain has socialized medicine? I do. I mean, anybody think it doesn't have socialized medicine? No. How many think that France and Germany have socialized medicine? Or Japan? Or Sweden? There is a general sense when we hear the term socialized medicine, T.R. Reid explains it very well in simple language, that all these industrialized countries that cover everybody in the population has a similar kind of government-run system. That is not the case. And I'm going to pass these things around. There are four basic systems of healthcare delivery, and they're listed on this sheet that's going around. The first is what's used in Germany, France, Belgium. It was first developed by Bismarck, you know, Otto von Bismarck, the Iron Chancellor, who unified Germany in the 1800s. In the 1880s, he instituted universal required health insurance for everybody in Germany. And Germany has had universal health insurance since the 1880s, the first country to have it. And remarkably, Germany has everybody in Germany, the payers and the providers, are all independent. They're not the government. Isn't that remarkable, huh? How many people knew that? And hardly anybody in the United States knows that. They're non-profit, they're highly regulated, but they're independent of the government. So that the doctors run their own private practices, they collect from these insurance companies. There's over 200 insurance companies. The insurance companies are run more like charities in Germany, but they're independent private insurance companies. And everybody has to have insurance. It's a mandated insurance. So that's Germany, France, Belgium have that. Japan has that same system. The second system listed on there is the Beveridge. William Beveridge was a social reformer in England in the 1940s and was the father of the National Health Service in Britain. And the Scandinavian countries, Great Britain, and some other, Cuba, have that system. Now, that's what we usually think of as being a socialized system. That's where all the healthcare is paid out of the government taxation. The government taxes, government negotiates the fees. Almost all the hospitals are owned by the government. And many of the physicians are employed by the government. Some physicians work on a fee-for-service basis, but mostly it's governmental-run, governmental-controlled. That's what we generally think of as socialized medicine. We have part of our system is exactly the same. The VA system here is exactly that. Government owns the hospitals. Government employs the doctors. Nobody sees a bill. No patient ever sees a bill in Britain. There's just no bills are ever given to a patient in Great Britain or in Scandinavia. But they are, and it's the same thing at the VA. Have you ever been to the VA? Has anybody been to the VA hospital here? If you have, you know, you get good care, you get it taken care of, and the government handles the whole, everything is handled. You never see a bill. The Bismarck system, that first system, is what our private insurance system is without the regulation and with profit. We are companies all run on a profit basis. So they run less efficiently and they cost more, but they're modeled after the Bismarck system. The third system on there is the single payer. You hear a lot about single payer. That's really the Canadian system. Canada has 13 individual, each province or territory has its own health care system. Single payer, the government pays it, but all the providers are independent practitioners. And so that's the single payer system. And we have a single payer system in the United States for part of our service. That's the Medicare system. And so anybody on Medicare is actually part of a single payer system. And the fourth thing is out of pocket. And all the third world countries are out of pocket. And all of our uninsured people are out of pocket. And that is that is where they cut you off at the door. You don't have the money, you don't get taken care of. So if you're in Africa or Latin America and you have an illness, if you can't come up with the money, you're not going to get much in the way of care. Now, you may be able to get some charity from some free clinics or clinics run by the churches or charitable organizations, but as far as the government's concerned, they're not going to be providing any services.
Question, when you say government, but this is by taxation. The money's got to come from someplace.
That's right. The government gets its money by taxing.
Yeah. And is that pretty much the same for everybody? Is it going
no, taxes, the taxing systems are vary widely by government as to how much is income tax, how much is property, excise tax. A lot of these countries have something called a value-added tax. Every transaction is taxed, sort of like a sales tax on every little step of the way. So the taxing system is very different in different places, but that's where money comes from. And then the government goes and subsidizes some of the programs. The point of bringing all that up is that to counteract this thing about the distinction between socialized, what you're going to hear is socialized medicine, people need to define the terms. Germany, France have wonderful healthcare systems. They have universal coverage, and there's nothing socialized about it at all. I mean, there's no the government is playing a role, but the government plays a regulatory role, and the practitioners are independent. They're not earning as much as practitioners in the States. The insurance companies clearly are not, because they are nonprofit agents. But I think it's important to know that we can modify our healthcare system without necessarily going to a British system, or without necessarily going to a Canadian system, which is a single payer. And I think there are a lot of very bright people in Washington, D.C. that understand that. But the general population has a real problem in getting their hands around. And I think all of us do, because it's so complex. And I think if we break it down into our system is broken, we would need universal health care, which is and how we get that. It almost doesn't matter how we get there. And so Obama is absolutely right when he said it doesn't matter how we get there. But that's what we have to get there. It's just that we can't say we're not going to get there, because that's a moral issue. And then the limits are something that we will have to, as a society, gradually educate ourselves into accepting. Because we have to be an adult society that says we do not have unlimited everything. And so if you have more money on healthcare means less money for the environment, less money for public safety, less money for education, less money for all the other things that you think you want the government to do for you.
Well, now, in England, for example, they have a national health care system that you can also buy private insurance, I understand, so that if you want a higher level of service, or if you want procedures covered that the government program doesn't cover, then you can buy supplementary insurance.
Precisely, and I think any system will, all in the United States, there will always be the option for those people who have more money that want to buy up and buy additional insurance coverage or just be able to go out into the market and get things that would not otherwise be covered under a basic plan. It's kind of, you know, I mean, we don't provide clothes for everybody. We don't provide refrigerators for everybody. We're not going to provide every possible health care treatment, especially if things of marginal benefit. But there's a sense, at least I have a sense, that we do have a moral obligation to provide a basic package for everybody.
But you mentioned in this ARC system that it's jointly financed by employers and government. What is the individual's commitment in that system?
It varies from country to country, but in every country, the employee also makes a contribution, but it's withheld by the employer, so that it's just like it is in this country, very similar, but the amount that's withheld is varied according to income, whether you're a salaried employee, whether you're an hourly employee. In France, makes a difference. It's every country has their own system that's
there
a little
is
bit
some
different.
Commitment for the
right, and if
individual.
if you lose your job, you just continue right on that on that insurance policy. If you meet certain criteria, the government will step in and subsidize that. Okay. If you don't meet those criteria, if you have sufficient resources, you will be asked to pay the premium yourself. But you're automatically covered, and you continue on with the coverage. So we've taken three quarters of an hour on this healthcare stuff, not a whole lot on aging. But I can't think of any issue that's more timely and it's going to have a greater impact on all of us than the issue of healthcare reform. So I hope I haven't bored you all or preached too much, and I hope you have enough information there and enough references to get on the internet, to educate yourselves, and to enter into these conversations with your friends and neighbors and fellow people in the congregation to see if we can't have a higher level of discourse.
If I get into a discussion, which I know I will, with people who do not agree with me, where can I tell them this data came from? On the four systems? Can I get that?
You can get it right from here. I mean, I stole some of it right out of this book because he described it so well and summarized it. I mean, he has helped me understand. And I say the majority of physicians do not know how medicine. I mean, I lived for a brief time in the United Kingdom, so that I have a pretty good sense of what the national health system is, and I have a pretty good feel for that. I really did not know and understand how Italy was different from Belgium, was different from Sweden, which was a little different from Germany. And I kind of lumped them together as well in my own thinking, and that's not the case. And we certainly should be able to take some ideas from these other countries and adapt and tweak and twist our own system here without the kind of disruptions. We tried to come in and put a single-payer system in, the disruptions would be so huge that it would never happen. It was never on the table. Obama was totally right, and you know that was a non-starter, and I think politically that was astute and a reasonable decision. Even though, if you ask me what I would choose personally, I think expanding Medicare to cover everybody makes the most sense, and since the system's already there, but I don't think that's good. That's a possibility.
Say again, why you think that's not a possibility? Why we can't implement the best system?
We will eventually get to something that's similar to that, but it's going to take time. It'd be too much disruption right now with all the other insurance companies and the people that are employed. I mean, there may be ways to get there. Politically, it just isn't going to. I mean, we can't even get. I mean, look at the struggle to make some rather modest changes that move us in the right direction. How difficult that's been.
Well, what do you think is the most likely that we could go to?
I think the most likely is that we're going to do something similar to what Germany and France have, and that the insurance companies, we're going to regulate the insurance companies. We're going to gradually, progressively, we're going to eliminate the fact that they can exclude people because of a prior existing condition. Well, that's going to go. I think that has to go. I think we will, as part of that, we will move them closer to nonprofit status with time. I think the government will regulate the insurance companies progressively tighter and tighter, so that they, I mean, Blue Cross Blue Shield started out almost everywhere as a nonprofit, and they all converted to a profit status, and they have investors, and so they have to market. They have more expense on market, on advertising, and on profits. So they're taking anywhere from 15% to 25% of your health care dollars are just being taken right off the top, and they never get back into even to provide health care.
Of these high dollars, almost $7,000 per person.
Yeah, so that's a big chunk of the money that's going elsewhere.
Well, how do you think you can reverse that trend? Because they're not going to want to give it up anymore than the other companies want to give up their dollars that they do.
It's going to take political will. It's going to take an educated public. It's going to take a recognition. Certainly, what's driving this is American industry. Are the big companies that are saying, we can't afford this. We can't compete on the international market because we're not sharing. You know, it's not being appropriately shared. It's coming back because they're paying these high, high premiums. I mean, and a lot of the big companies are self-insuring. They're just eliminating the insurance companies out of the thing. Hewlett Packard, I think, just self-insured. I mean, they just run their own insurance company, essentially, for their employees. But they don't really want to do that. It's not their business. I mean, they're better at making computers and lab equipment. They don't really want to run an insurance company if they don't have to.
Current trend's even worse than that on the big companies. What they're doing is they're farming out their insurance. They're telling the employees after a certain date, no more.
Yeah, that's a less ethical position to take, but it's understandable.
Yeah.
That's why it's unsustainable. I mean, we can't go on the way it is. It's just, and it's a recognition is that, I think Obama said in his address to Congress, was that our financial crisis is our health care crisis. That we're not going to solve the financial crisis until we get a handle on the health care. I want to say a couple things about aging. Can we do that? Okay, I got another handout. I have to hang on to one of these myself. All right, and we can talk on any. The only day that we really have to talk about what I said we're going to talk about is Wednesday, which is the discussion on faith and medicine. But we can talk if we want to talk more about aging. Let me ask a couple. Let me tell you what my outline for aging would have been. I was going to thank you all for coming, and I was going to talk about philosophical questions about aging. Say something about longevity and successful aging, about something about how we die, and advice for successful aging. So let me just throw some philosophical questions that you all can ponder and think about, and think about the ethical implications of these things. Is there a maximum age limit for humans? Should we attempt to extend that age limit? That's an important thing if we learn how. And is ageless youth better than the seasons of life? Should age be a factor in rationing health care? And what are the benefits of and disadvantages of the elderly being segregated into retirement villages and nursing homes? So these are the kind of issues that have some ethical overtone. I have, Jim Bodine, I have to tell you this, and that anybody else that wants this, I have the kernel of an idea for a great, great novel. And if someone wants to pick this up, they can take my idea. It's the best of Michael Crichton and Robin Cook and Cliff Hall all put together. And what it relates to is the genes. See, I have a theory on aging, and that there's one gene that you have to have in order to develop. So a fertilized egg, if it doesn't have that gene, will never go anywhere. But that same gene puts the limit on your lifespan. It's essentially the biological clock gene. But it's just one gene, and it's there. But it has to be there at birth. That's why everybody has it, and nobody lives longer than 100 years. And if somebody sometime is going to figure out how to genetically engineer and turn that off, when you turn it off, you stop the aging process right there, whatever age you are at that time. Now, the novel, of course, is that some researcher in some little laboratory, some university, or at the NIH or something, discovers this. And also, the mafia finds out that he has this information, because you know how valuable this is. I mean, this is really valuable. That you know that you can, you know, a 26-year-old person can shut off aging, or 45, or if you're 85 already, you at least you won't get any older. So the intrigue, the Moscow people want it, and the mafia wants it, and the U.S. government is trying to keep it secret. Oh, it's just great. So anyway, there are lots of theories about aging. Why we age, and we certainly do age. And if you look at the, if we look at the first curve, the one at the top, which is percent survival, and we see 1500 AD, and I just picked a number, and we saw that if you were born, there was a lot of mortality very early in life, kind of flattened out during the middle years, and there were people that made it to 90 and 100 years old even way back when. Yeah. It was extremely rare, but there weren't very many people that made it to 80 back then, so there weren't too many that made it to 100. By 2009, the curve has shifted considerably. We don't have that mortality early on anywhere near as much, but things drop off very, very fast toward the end. And we see an idealized form is if we essentially wiped out almost all disease, we would live, a nice, everybody would survive until we got close to 100, we'd all kind of drop off at 100. The oldest documented person in the world was 122 years old. The oldest lady that was alive, the oldest person that was alive last, I think a week before last week, 115, died in Los Angeles. Her favorite foods were fried chicken, bacon, and ice cream. So obviously she didn't listen to her doctors who were, two generations younger telling her, she had to cut out the bacon, or something. The oldest woman, the 122-year-old lady, was a French lady, and when she died, she was blind, she was deaf, she was in a nursing home, she had terrible, painful arthritis, she was essentially bedridden. So there's not really when you look at that, not many of us probably want necessarily that distinction of being the oldest person that ever lived. But it is kind of phenomenal that despite all the medical advances and everything else, we really have not extended life expectancy very much at all. That being said, the numbers of people that are going to be old in the next years is phenomenal. Just listen to this. Right now, there are 75,000 people in the United States that are over 100 years old. 75,000. Wow. There's going to be more than 1 million by 2050. So in 2050, I'll be 107, or at least let's put it this way. I will have been born 107 years ago. there'll be 1 million estimated. There are 75 million people alive in the United States today who will reach 90 or above by 2020. 50% of the 74 million baby boomers who are alive today will reach greater than 85. And by 2050, there will be 16 million Americans who are more than 85 years old. Huge, huge elderly population that's going to require a huge amount of expenditures in terms of assistance, home health assistance, health care. You work with hospice, you can just imagine what that's going to be. So The next thing to look at is the bottom curve, and we got about 2 minutes. Look at the bottom curve, life expectancy. And it goes back into geologic time, because I have to put that in there, that 10,000 BC, is that geologic time? That's like 1 second on the 24-hour clock. Oh, well, you know, medicine just doesn't carry the...
Wait.
You're right. You know, I mean, it just, we did, you know, that's why the geologists always get the girls, you know? Have you ever noticed that? So if you look, it didn't change much at all. Life expectancy was pretty miserable. In fact, just to put it in perspective, in 2,000 years ago in Rome, life expectancy was 22 years. So when Jesus was crucified at the age of 33 or 34, whatever, how old he was, he had already outlived his life expectancy by 11 years.
He had a mother that was still alive. She was pretty old then.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And the thing about life expectancy that's so misleading, we have this feeling that if life expectancy is 40 someplace, that everybody drops dead by the time they get to 40, and that's not the case at all. There's just so much infant mortality that just skews the... We're looking at average deaths as to when they occur. So there were still people in the time of Jesus that lived... to ripe old age, into the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. But you see what happened to life expectancy, it has just skyrocketed in the last 100 years. And in fact, just to put that into perspective, if you were born in 1900, your life in the United States, your life expectancy was 49 years.
What year?
1900. And not by, if you were born in 1946, your life expectancy had increased to 66. And if you're born in now, your life expectancy is around 77 years. So for every 4 days that you delayed being born, you gained 1 day in life expectancy. Put it another way, for every 4 years you delayed, you gained a year. So for all of you who are younger siblings, you're going to live longer than your oldest sibling. Not longer in terms of, how many, what year you're going to die, but you will have a longer life expectancy. Phenomenal when you think about that. And almost all of that occurred in the first half of the century. Long before we had antibiotics, before we had open heart surgery, before we had clot-busting drugs, before we had angioplasty or bypass surgery, Bob. Right now, it's for every 10 years you delay, you gain a year. Over the whole century, it was for every 4, and at one point it was like for every 3 years back early in the century. The life expectancy was increasing so rapidly with immunizations, with treatment, at that time. But the real thing that drove it was good water and an understanding. It's only been since the 1880s that we even understood that bacteria caused infection. I mean, that just, every time I think about that, it blows me away. And I think that when I was born, there was no penicillin.
Right.
No other antibiotics. They had some sulfa drugs that weren't really antibiotics, but that's all we had when most of us were born. So it's kind of phenomenal what's happened, and yet the big increase in life expectancy occurred all before that. And that occurred with marked improvement in socioeconomic status, with industrialization, and with public health measures. So we've used up our time. If we want to talk more about aging at the Thursday session, or we want to concentrate more on ethical issues, Friday will be mostly end of life. I'm open to suggestions. We can really talk about anything you want to talk. We can talk about H1N1. If you're interested in that. So anything that's a burning issue, we did spend a lot of time on the healthcare crisis, but I think it's really such a critical issue. I have one other handout for you. And this talk, no, I don't have this for you. We'll deal with this at another time. There's a movie. The movie's going to be... if you think I'm preaching, the movie really preaches.
It's a good movie.
But the new movie has some really super, besides me, and it it has some, it has some professors of medicine from Harvard, former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, a number of really high-powered people talking about their view of the healthcare system, the profit motive that's within the healthcare system, why it's as inefficient and unethical as it seems to be. Yes?
Assuming we like the movie, is there a way to get copies of it?
Well, we talked about that earlier. If you have facilities here to duplicate this, that would not violate any copyright. So if we can put this into a computer and
talk to the media people
and burn a disk.
And that's when and where?
That's going to be here at 8:15 after Vespers.
Can we just say
thank you. Vespers is in 10 minutes.